for members only. Golf Smarter Premium, number 473, published on January 27, 2015. Three critical elements for a great golf swing with Jim Waldron.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Jim.
Thanks, Fred. Great to be here again.
And last time we spoke, I think you were up in Portland, and yep. Where you spend most of your year teaching at the Balance Point Golf School, but not now.
Now I'm on the North Shore of Oahu. This is my 21st year where I get to spend most of the winter time in Hawaii.
Little better than Portland weather, huh?
Oh, yeah, it's much better. So, and you know, when I spend my actual home is actually east of Portland, 7 hours up in the Wallowa Mountains. And so right now at my house, it's probably, 10 degrees above zero with a couple feet of snow on the ground. So this is quite the contrast.
Yeah, nice. Nice. All right, we all hate you. Now let's get on with the show.
Yeah, I get that a lot.
Yeah, I bet. I guess right now you and I are the only two people in the industry who are not at the PGA show.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a couple times.
Oh, you have?
It's a cool thing. It's a fun show. It's geared more toward the club professional, director of golf, general manager, than teaching pros. I mean, it's more of a merch. That's why they call it the merchandise show.
Yeah, well, isn't it more for buyers than it's?
Well, yeah, it's basically a trade show for the golf industry that's put on by the PGA of America. But it's mainly the equipment companies. That's pretty much
right. Yeah. Do you anticipate hearing anything new and exciting this year?
You know, I think we're pretty close to have reached the point of no return on the technology front. I mean, there's only so much tweaking they can do given the rules, the RNA and the USGA limits to what, how much better technology can get. So unless they change the rules dramatically, we're not going to see, I don't think, significant technological improvements.
So that means that people are going to have to keep their driver for more than a year?
Yeah.
How are we going to survive if we can't buy new drivers thinking it's going to add 10 yards every single year?
And it's funny because I think that is part of the reason we're hearing about declining participation rates. I think that kind of marketing strategy is sort of boomerang. I think a lot of golfers are feeling a bit ripped off by the equipment company marketing hype.
Really? Yeah. I mean, you're getting a sense from your students. You hear that kind of feedback?
Yeah, because if you're a company that puts out a new driver every 6 months and the driver is supposed to be 17 yards or whatever it is, 12 yards further, you total it up in 5 years, you should be hitting your driver like 600 yards, right? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So, at some point, the logical mind of the golfer kicks in and goes, wait a minute, this doesn't seem right. So,
I don't know. But, and they're still not getting fitted for the club anyway. They're just buying what their friend has.
Well, some are getting fitted, but which definitely helps. But and don't get me wrong. I mean, some of the newer stuff in the last few years.
There was a huge change in the equipment, but now, like you said, they've kind of reached the limits.
Yeah, I mean the lower spin. If you're a decent player with relatively high club head speed, those low spin drivers really do help you hit the ball further. There is no question. No question about it. So even though I'm getting up in age, I'm 63 now, I still have fair amount of club head speed. And I've always struggled with hitting these, especially in the wind in Hawaii, hitting the driver high where it hits the – if you have too much spin, it'll just carry on that wind and balloon and you lose a lot of distance. So I've been playing around with the SLDR. Haven't quite got it figured out yet as far as where I want to put the settings. I'm still testing it. But it definitely hits it further because it does spin less.
Wow. But shouldn't the average golfer, the recreational golfer who mid to higher handicap, shouldn't they avoid those adjustable clubs? Shouldn't they get it set once and just leave it be?
Well, I think that's what they mostly do. It just sort of makes it easier to do a little bit of testing on your own because, you really don't have time in a fitting to totally nail it down. And the fitting is designed to kind of get you in the ballpark. Then you got to kind of tweak it by going to the range and taking it to the course and playing in real world conditions and figuring out, you know, most people generally play one to maybe five courses that are on their kind of the rota for golf courses they play frequently. And so they kind of know, you know, what, because, you know, so much of it depends on how firm the fairways are and what the wind is like, those two things. And also how long the golf course is. And you've got to dial in the trajectory that will produce the overall maximum amount of carry and roll. Right. And so like in Hawaii, where oftentimes you're hitting into a wind, generally speaking, the good Hawaii players hit a low draw. That's the shot you see good players hit here all the time off the tee. I mean, really low by mainland standards. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time they don't do that is if it's been raining a lot, then they might, if the fairways are really soft, which isn't that often, they'll bump up the loft on the setting. And then you want to get most of your distance from carry. But typically in Hawaii, the fairways are pretty firm, particularly on the side of the island that I live on, which is the drier side.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get – I've seen people all the time get 30, 40, 50 yards of roll here all the time.
Wow.
And so if you couple a low spin driver that hits it low to begin with, low-ish, so it'll bore through the wind better with relatively low backspin, you might carry it out there in a – say a 2-club wind, you might hit it out there at 230 to 250 in the air and then get 30, 50 yards of roll on it.
For those of us who get to play golf in the winter, and I apologize to all of those who are confined for 4 to 5 to 8 months and don't get to play, but for those who do get to play 12 months a year, why is winter golf so much more difficult? I've noticed that, you know, when I look back at my scores year to year to year, they balloon in, you know, October, November, December,
sure.
January. Things just go up. It's like, what is so different about the game?
Well, you don't get the runoff, like we said. You don't get the roll on the driver typically. So the ball just sort of sits and even might even plug. It won't roll at all. So
and it doesn't fly as far.
Doesn't fly as far. The ball's colder. You're colder, so you're not moving. Your muscles aren't warm enough, and so you're not contracting the muscles efficiently. Hmm. You're not loose enough. You're tighter. All those things reduce your club head speed. Then you got to deal with the mud and the bad lies. And you know, if it's a summertime lie and you hit it, say like a 16th of an inch fat, it's still going to go out there close to the normal distance, right? Might be 5 yards short or something if you're normal carry. You get a 16th of an inch fat and the ground soaking wet, the ball's going nowhere. So it's just harder for all those reasons.
And how do we remedy that? What do we do to...
Don't play in the wintertime.
Move to the East Coast or into the northern part, or move to your place in Portland or east of Portland and just hide yourself in the snow. Okay, so but those of us who are weather wimps and won't move to the cold weather...
Well, you're asking the wrong guy. I'm like the worst. I'm the worst cold weather rain. I don't even play in the cold. I just don't do it. I just don't enjoy it.
Yeah, no. I don't either. I mean, I definitely a light drizzle maybe, but if it's rain, I'm not interested in playing.
Yeah, no, I play in the rain here because it's warm rain, but I don't like where it's cold and rainy. I don't find it fun at all.
Last time I was in Hawaii, I was on Kauai and I played in Poipu. And the pro there, and he's been on the show, I can't remember his name, I'm sorry, but he was saying that that's what the locals know about slowing your swing speed in the big winds.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is if you swing, see, the more club head speed you have, everything else being equal, the more backspin you produce, on the cover of the ball. When the back third of the ball gets squished between the against the club face, that creates friction, which creates backspin. So if you have a lot of club head speed and you're hitting into a wind, you get that ballooning ball effect, like I mentioned, where it might start out at normal trajectory, then it quickly balloons straight up and then falls straight down. You get literally no roll. So the idea in the wind, this has been known for years, for generations, really, if you take one or two more clubs and then cut your tempo down by maybe 10 or 20%. So instead of doing like a number 10 speed, swing it like a number 8 speed. And that produces, you know, like in baseball, a knuckleball, it produces almost knuckleball effect on the golf ball. So it'll bore through the wind with very little spin.
Do you think there's any chance that, you know, we talked about the clubs reaching their limit in development. What do you think about the golf balls? Do you think there's any change in the future for golf balls? Maybe be smaller, or I mean,
well, you know, there used to be. Are you aware there used to be a smaller ball?
Yeah, I read that recently. I was blown away by it, and they travel farther.
They go further. Yeah, they're a little harder to make solid contact with because they're smaller, obviously. So it's a little harder to get the sweet spot on the back of the ball because it is smaller.
Well, but the when those balls were around, the club faces weren't as large as they are now either, right?
That's true. Yeah, yeah. But that was the British ball. That's the ball they played in Ireland and in the UK. And I forgot when it went out, but I think it was maybe 20-something years ago, 25 years ago, they made the switch to the American ball. And I don't even recall exactly what the American ball is 1.68 inches. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking the British ball was maybe 1.35 or 1.
Yeah, right.
Something like that. It was
very small, but
still. Yeah, it's pretty small.
So where is the innovation in golf going to come from?
It has to come from the instruction side, which is what I'm trying to do, as you know, and have been for 25 years.
That's why we've talked so frequently, because of your instruction and your insights.
Well, you know, we have this quit rate that's pretty high. We have the highest quit rate of any amateur sport, and have had for a long time, but it's gotten worse in the last, I don't know, 10, 12 years. Mm-hmm. The peak was, I think, in 2000. I think we had something like 35 million regular golfers in America.
What years do you think that was? I mean, how closely did that coincide with Tiger's peak?
Yeah, it was at the peak. Yeah, it was right around 2000, 2001, I believe. And then we've had declining participation rates. So we had that little bump from Tiger. You know, and I think the Tiger thing, people who normally wouldn't have any interest in taking up golf took up the game, particularly the millennial generation started taking up the game. And then it kind of fell off pretty sharply. And then after the economy collapsed in 2008, the participation really went down. The only place where it's significantly growing in participation rates right now is in a lot of the Asian countries.
Right.
China especially, India. And it's no secret that those two countries have the fastest growing middle class of any countries on the planet. Southeast Asia, Thailand, its middle class has grown fairly significantly. It's pretty popular there. Singapore, it's popular mostly among the wealthy elite. Indonesia, it's growing. Even Vietnam, it's starting to grow. So there's Asia sort of booming, but it's declining here for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons is it's always been a hard game to be reasonably, you know, at least reasonably good, which would be, I guess, what'd you call that? Maybe 15 handicap or better. But you know, most people are not a 15 handicap or better, as you know, they're higher than that. And some folks don't mind being a 25 handicap and never getting any better. But say by the end of their fifth year, they get down to a 25 or 20 somewhere in there, and they never see any improvement, but they're playing for social reasons, right? Primarily. But for the people who enjoy the challenge of getting better, a lot of those folks hit a wall, even if they take what I would call traditional instruction, and then they get some improvement. Well, a minority will get significant improvement, but the majority get little or no improvement. They get frustrated and they quit. So it's a big topic right now in the golf instruction world. How do we find a way to solve this dilemma? And I think the big mistake has been, this is going to sound strange coming from me, because early on in my career, I was known for the opposite of what I'm about to say. But I think there's been way too much sort of onus put on a quick fix in terms of science and technology, in terms of instruction. And we're starting to see the backlash in the last, I'd say, year or two. People are taking TrackMan lessons. They're taking three-dimensional, 3D swing capture, motion capture technology lessons. And again, there will always be a minority that will improve no matter what type of lesson you give them. But for the vast majority of people, they're walking. This is the feedback I'm hearing from students who go this route and come to see me. And they're saying, yeah, I understand now why I suck, but I can't, but I'm not any better from knowing how bad I am at this, right? And from seeing myself compared to Tiger in 16 different ways, I see that Tiger's doing these 16 things right, and I'm doing the 16 things totally the opposite. But how does that help me be better? In other words, if it's purely intellectual knowledge, which most of this sort of high-tech, science-oriented instruction is geared toward, if it doesn't translate into the subconscious mind, which is the part of your brain that controls your body motion in every sport, right, then what good is it? Then the answer is not very much.
I think that what I personally have experienced is that course management, more than swing mechanics, helped me lower my score.
Yeah. Well, that's a cool thing about golf. I mean, the good teachers know this, that there is more than one way to lower your score. But the thing about a lot of golfers is they're not like you. They don't really, at least is what they claim. I mean, I'm not sure it's 100% true, but...
Is that your phone or is that really a rooster?
That's actually a rooster, yeah. Roosters are all over the island.
Sorry.
See how bad is it 3 a.m. when they're doing that.
Oh, that's really funny.
A lot of people, it's not so much about score. I'm in this camp, actually. It's about how you make the score. And, you know, most people who I interview, potential new students, I ask you, would you rather lower your score by any means necessary, or is there a precise way you want to play golf? And 9 out of 10 people will tell you they want to be good in the long game, right? And so they don't care about course management.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter if they're on the range or on the golf course. When you miss hit a golf shot badly, you get a bad feeling in your mind and your body, right? It doesn't feel good. It feels kind of embarrassing or humiliating or depressing, or you get angry. You want to learn how to find that sweet spot more often, right? And that's the big challenge to golf. I mean, if anybody spends enough time on a putting green without any professional instruction, they'll figure out a way to be at least a decent putter, if not a great putter. Same with maybe chip shots, little short chip shots around the green. If you spend enough time, you're going to figure out a way to be halfway decent at those two skills. If someone like a 3-iron off a tight lie in a fairway, good luck.
Owns a 3-iron?
Well, that's the traditional. It used to be a 2-iron, even a 1-iron when I was a kid. But
yeah, right. But when we're talking about these 15 handicap and above, they don't own 3-irons.
No, but I'm saying that would be the challenge. If they have a good swing, I mean, if you have a really good swing, you should be able to hit a 1-iron off the fairway, right? I mean, it shouldn't matter.
Right.
The point is that is a hard shot. Even a hybrid even a 3-hybrid off a tight lie, if you're an average golfer with not a very good golf swing, is something you're not going to hit it that well that often. So it comes down to how do you master a golf swing that will allow you to play good golf for a lot of years into the future. That's the thing that, trust me, almost every teaching pro, that's what we hear all the time, is how do I hit the ball more consistently, better more consistently.
Now, we all know there's no perfect in golf. It doesn't exist.
Right.
It can't. So how do you master a golf swing?
Boy, that's like a podcast that would have to be like 1,000 hours long. But, it's such a huge topic. But, I mean, it starts with the obvious, the basic stuff, which would be, A, you have to be reasonably healthy and fit. You can't have any kind of major injury like low back or wrist or shoulder. You got to be reasonably healthy. You have to have a reasonably strong core. You have to be reasonably flexible, right, in order to do the proper motion. So I would start there with you have to be somewhat fit. You have to have golf clubs that are somewhat close to fitting you perfectly. They don't have to be perfect, but they have to be in the ballpark. You can't play good golf with an instrument that doesn't fit your body, right? So.
Right.
You know, it's clubs the right length, the right overall weight, things like that. And then it's grip stance, grip setup. And by grip, I don't mean just hand position. I mean overall grip pressure and some other stuff having to do with your hands. Your setup, your starting position is really, really – that's probably the most important mechanical fundamental is to set up. And there's no reason not to set up as well as a tour pro. It takes zero athletic ability. All it takes is standing in front of a mirror for, a few minutes a day for about maybe 6 weeks, and you can master a tour pro setup. And then aim, you have to be able to aim the club face exactly at your target. That's often not discussed, but I would guess that in our golf, we do these three-day boot camp golf schools called Great Shot, and I would estimate at least 95% of our students are badly misaiming the club face, sometimes by as much as 30 to 40 yards off with their driver. Typically, it's to the, if they're a right-handed golfer, it's to the right. So I'll say aim at that telephone pole holding up the driving range net on the far left pole. And they'll aim at the middle pole, which is, you know, 40 yards to the right of the far left pole. And I'll go, are you aiming at the far left pole? And I'll point at it. They'll go, yeah. I go, no, you're aiming at that one that's three poles over. And then he doesn't believe me, so I put my alignment stick down in line with his club face, so it's perpendicular to the club face, and hold it real still. And he walks behind me and sees it, and you should see the look on people's faces.
Hmm.
And they're like, well, no wonder I can't play, because I'm not even aiming it close to where I think I am. So those have traditionally been called the three pre-swing fundamentals, pre-motion fundamentals. You know, and to be honest, if you're about a 12 handicap or higher, the odds of you being spot on grip pressure, setup, and aim are close to 0%. That's how rare it is.
Hmm.
If you're a 12 or higher. So if you're like a, you know, 12 handicap to 35 handicap, there's a really strong chance that you're somewhere between a little bit off and more likely way off in those three really, really important fundamentals. So it starts with those three. And then, you know, the really hard part is once your three pre-swing fundamentals are spot on, then you've got to get the motion parts, you know, the moving body part fundamentals to be correct. And that's where it's I would say traditional instruction has fallen down for lots of reasons. But in the motion itself, there's three basic categories. There's mechanics, which is basically how the body parts move. You know, the range of motion that they move on, the angles relative to the ground, relative to each other, you know, the so-called swing plane or swing geometry stuff. That's the mechanics. And then there's balance, which is a really important, I call that the supreme fundamental.
You call that the name of your school, don't you?
Yeah, the name of my school is called Balance Point. Because of the three, which are coordination, balance, and mechanics, balance trumps mechanics and coordination.
Wow. Whereas
you could have the best swing in the world right now. Actually, I just saw a guy at the Sony Open last week who I'm now putting up tied with Justin Rose as best golf swing in the world. This 21-year-old kid who shot 61 on Friday at Wailea, Justin Thomas. I didn't even know he shot 61. I happened to be there early Friday afternoon, and I had a meeting and at lunch, and then after that I went to the range, and it was about 1 o'clock, and he had just shot 61, unbeknownst to me. But I always go watch whoever has the best swing in the range. And so I happened to just watch him, and I was like, wow, who's this kid, Justin Thomas? Never heard of him before. But for your listeners, go YouTube Justin Thomas golf swing. You're going to see it literally a technically perfect golf swing.
Hmm.
So you could have Justin Thomas or Justin Rose's golf swing mechanically, and their tempo and their rhythm, which is the coordination part. So the timing part, right? The sequencing part. But if you lose your balance at any point in the swing, you're going to hit a terrible shot, right? So those are the three things. You got to learn to swing. You have to learn a motion, a golf swing motion, where you start out in rock solid balance. You swing in rock solid balance. Rock solid balance was Ben Hogan's term, by the way. And you finish in rock solid balance. And then you got to do the timing part, which is basically for mid to high handicaps. That's mainly swinging at the proper speed, the proper tempo with good rhythm, right? So that's sort of a very big picture overview, Fred, of what it would take to, you know, get your mind wrapped around how do I learn to hit the ball better.
I want to back up to aim for just a moment. Are you talking about in your pre-shot routine aiming? Where are we aiming? Are we aiming the ball? Are we aiming our feet?
Only aiming one thing. The only thing that matters, not the only thing, but the main thing that matters by far is only one thing, and that's the club face. So that means the leading edge, which is the bottom edge on an iron, and the top line, which applies on a wood or a hybrid. You want to have the leading edge or the top line, as the case may be, exactly 90 degrees to your target line. So your target line is that imaginary line in the ground that runs from your feet when you stand at the beginning of your routine, when you stand behind the ball, about 10 feet behind your ball, and you look down on the ground, and you got to put a line there, imaginary line between you know where your feet are through the ball all the way out to your target. That's your target line. It's this imaginary line in the ground. And then when you walk in and aim your club face, when you start to set up to the ball, you got to put that club face exactly 90 degrees to that line on the ground. So the club face is aiming exactly at your target. Now, of course, this is if you're trying to hit a straight ball. You're not trying to curve it on purpose, right? It's a little different if you're trying to slice it or hook it. But that's what you have. And then all you're doing with your body, with your feet, your knees, your hips, your shoulders, your eyes, your head, is you're aligning your body on a second line on the ground, which is called the body line, which is roughly 3 feet parallel left of your target line, right? So you got like a railroad track. You got the two tracks of a railroad.
Right.
There's the inner track where you're standing, where your feet are, and there's the outer rail, which is where the target line is. So you got these two parallel tracks, right? And so what you have to realize is almost everybody who comes to see me doesn't understand this. This is one of the reasons why I always use the word illusions a lot in my teaching. And one of the big ones is called the parallax illusion, which is if you and I were in Kansas in a cornfield with a railroad track running through it, flat, all the way to the horizon, nothing but cornfields, and we're standing on the railroad tracks looking out to the horizon, it's going to look like the rails get closer together the further out they go, right?
Yep.
That's the parallax illusion. And so the reason why people, mid to high handicaps especially, struggle with aim is a lot of them don't even know you're supposed to really aim the club face precisely at the target line, at the target along
no,
the target.
No, that we focus on our stance and our feet.
Yeah, and your body is not – I hit shots all the time in the school where my feet, even my shoulder girdle, is – 30 degrees left or right of where my club face is pointing, and I still hit the ball exactly where the target is. The body has almost, I won't say none, but it has very little influence on where the ball goes. What matters is where the club face is pointing. It's like aiming the sight line on a gun. You got to aim the club face precisely at your intended target.
Now, when you talk about the club face aiming at the target, we're talking about at address or obviously at contact.
Well, contact too, if you're trying to hit a straight ball, yeah. But it starts with setup. So when you're setting up to the ball, part of setup is this aim and alignment procedure. You're aiming the club face. You're aligning your body parallel left of the target line, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so those two lines never get further away and they never get closer together. So I get people all the time. In fact, I had a mechanical engineer, I'll never forget, from Mexico years ago, like 15 years ago, come up to Portland to take the school. He was about an 18 handicap, if I remember right, something like 15 handicap maybe. And I was explaining this, and he goes, no, that's not right. He goes, if I don't aim my body at the target, how is the ball going to go there? I go, really? I go, why would you have to aim your body at the target? I go, are you going to shoot yourself out of a cannon? Are you going to the target? No, you're standing to the side of the target. In golf, we stand to the side of the ball. We stand to the side of the target line, which connects the ball to the target. We're not straddling it like in croquet, where you're running a croquet mallet, through your legs, right? But the issue is most other sports, with a few exceptions, your body line and your target line are the same line. So when you serve a tennis ball, the two lines are the same. You're standing on the target line, right?
Yeah.
When you shoot an arrow or shoot a rifle, you're standing on the target line.
Shooting a basket, throwing a ball.
Shooting a basketball, same lines. But imagine if rifle shooting was like golf, and I actually do this in the school. I take my golf club and turn it into a rifle, hold it like a rifle against my shoulder,
mm-hmm.
and then I stick my arms out to full extension in front of me, and then I pull the trigger. In other words, in golf, you're standing to the side about 3 feet or so to the side of the actual target. You're not standing on top of the target line, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that really matters is, though not the only thing again, but the main thing that really matters is, are you aiming the club face exactly at the target or not? And because of that illusion I mentioned, people either consciously or unconsciously or both, they aim, particularly the left side of their shoulder girdle, they aim that at the target. So they, you watch high handicap golfers, they look over their, they like, they sight along their left shoulder and try to get their left shoulder in line with what they perceive their target to be out there. And good players don't do that because they know that their left shoulder should never aim at the target, ever. No part of your body ever aims at the target, ever.
Hmm.
Not your feet, not your knees, not nothing. You're standing to the side of the target line, right? But if you aim your left shoulder at the target, even if you did start out by aiming the club face correctly, if you then rotate your chest so your left shoulder is aiming at the target and you look down at your club face, which is actually aiming at the target, it'll look like it's aiming to the left of the target. And you'll either consciously or unconsciously or both, you will rotate the face open to the right. And now it'll look in your mind like it's pointing at the target. It's not. It's pointing to the right of the target. That's the most common mistake we see in aim and alignment. People misaim the club face way, way right of where they think they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now we have, let's just pretend that our feet are aligned just to the side of the target, not at the target, and our club face is pointing directly at the target. We're in alignment there, and I'm still hooking the ball.
Oh, there could be, but so you're asking why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, this is one of the first things I tell my new students. You have to realize that the game of golf, particularly the long game, the ball striking part we're talking about, is so complex that when you fix one area and make it more how a pro does it, it's in no way, shape, or form a guarantee you're going to hit a good shot.
Mm.
It just increases the probability you'll hit a good shot, right? So you could have the perfect aim and alignment, and you could still hit it 50 yards left or right of your target because of things that are going to happen incorrectly in your body and club motion, right?
And we wonder why people are leaving the game.
See, that's what I'm saying. People, I think a lot of people take up the game. They watch it on TV and they think, "Oh, I can do that. It looks simple."
Or they play a video game and think, "I can do this."
Exactly. Yeah. Because you know your club face, not just the club face, the entire club head is rotating in a huge 540 degree arc from the beginning of the swing to the end, in three spatial dimensions. It's going up toward the sky and the backswing, and then down toward the ground on the forward swing, and then up toward the sky again, right? It's going away from the target line on the backswing, and then it's going toward the target line on the downswing, and then away from the target line to the finish. And it's going in a big circle, we call that the horizontal dimension, away, you know, to the right of the target on the backswing, and then toward the target to the left on the forward swing. So the club head is moving in three spatial dimensions, right? The vertical dimension, the width dimension, the horizontal dimension. And you have the ability, because of human anatomy, you have the ability to rotate the face way open relative to that 540 degrees of path the club head's moving in, or way shut, which people do. I mean, typically, you know, average golfers do that. So the challenge is to learn something about the basic sort of physics and the basic geometry of what the club is supposed to do, and then how your body motion affects that. And we basically call that, there's six laws of club motion that people should know about if they want to learn to master ball striking. And there's 30 laws of body motion. Now, some of those are much more important than others, but of the 30 laws, there's about 10 that are really important and 20 not so much. But if you violate one of those 10 laws of body motion badly, right, then you're going to automatically violate at least one, probably all six laws of club motion. And that's why people find it difficult when they first take up the game as beginners, because they are violating those really important 10 laws of body motion.
Hmm. All right. So if we had, and I, it's hard to say everything being equal, but if somebody has excellent swing mechanics,
uh-huh,
and a lousy mental game, playing with somebody that has not such great mechanics, but an excellent mental game and attitude, and they're basically the same, you know, a handicap type thing. I mean, like, who's going to be the better player? I mean, what falls to be more important? do you think?
Yeah, it's real. A lot of it depends on what their it depends on what their handicap is, I think. But yeah,
let's
in general,
say they're equal. They're both 15s or 12s.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, literally, even if they're equal, it depends what their skill is in terms of scoring. But if there were two high handicaps, one with let's say there's 220 handicaps playing together, but one of the 20 handicaps is actually a 10 handicap ball striker, right? And the other guy. And he's a 30 handicap at the mental game. If you could handicap the skills like that, so he's a 30 handicap at the mind stuff, 10 handicap at the mechanical stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the opposite. The other guy, he's a 30 handicap ball striker, but he's a 10 handicap in mental game. I would say it would be a toss up. I would say they both would probably play pretty close to the same score. But where the mental game becomes more important is when you get down around 10 handicap or lower, then I would give the edge for sure to the mental hand, the guy with the better mind game. And if they were 35 handicaps, I would give the edge to the guy with the better golf swing mechanics.
And I've always been under the impression, or I actually, my whole basis on starting this show was I always felt that if you had a good mental game and understood course management, or I like to call that strategy, you can lower your score faster than if you just focus on your mechanics.
Well, there's no question about it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no question. From a speed of lowering your score, I tell this to my students all the time. I get a lot of these people who shoot between like 90 and 105. That's probably 2/3 of my new students are in that range.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I say to them, Do you want to lower your scores as quickly as possible by any means necessary? And you'd be surprised. Most people say no. Like I mentioned earlier, they go, no, I don't care about the short term. I just want to learn how to hit the ball closer to how a pro hits it, right? But for the guys who say yes, I do, I'll go to that guy's golf bag and I'll start throwing clubs out of the bag on the ground. Throw the driver on the ground. Throw the 3-wood on the ground, right? Throw the 3-hybrid on the ground and maybe leave everything else in. Right. Well, if there's a 4 or 5 iron, I'll throw those on the ground too. Like, okay, let's go play with that set. And the guy will go, well, I can't play without a driver. I go, well, that's the club that's costing you a lot of strokes, right? So you got to score well from a strategic standpoint. You have to know what your limitations are as a player, what your actual ability level is in terms of striking a golf ball. And don't try to hit any shots. Don't try to hit any hero shots that are mostly based on luck.
Right. Well, that's my number one edict, which is never follow a bad shot with a stupid shot.
Exactly. And know how far you actually hit the clubs. We've talked about that before. Know what your actual real world yardages are, not the 1 out of 10 good ones you hit in the range. That one doesn't count because you're only going to hit it 10% of the time. You got to know what your actual yardages are. And then I go do playing lessons with people where they only have maybe 6 or 7 clubs in the bag. And I tell them where to aim and what club to hit and how far they should try to hit it. And the guy who shoots 105 shoots like 92 the first time we do this. Right? And they can't believe it. They're like in shock. They go, that's really fast improvement. I go, well, yeah, because you think of all the lost balls, all the penalty strokes from lost balls. Or you know, or poor shots because you hit a ball in the rough or in the sand, you know. So strategy is certainly a very fast way. But then the other hand, you got a guy who's got a good strategy, has good clubs, knows his yardages, and is shooting say mid to high 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year goes by, no improvement. Another year goes by, no improvement. Well, there's just, in other words, strategy can only take you so far. Then you got to ask yourself, okay, how am I going to get better at this game? And it really comes down to, do you want to work on your mental game? Do you want to work on your ball striking? Do you want to work on your putting? Or do you want to work on your short game? Those are the 4 main skill areas. And I always tell people, look, especially if you're working for a living, you don't have time to change all 4 areas. Just pick 1 area of the 4 for the next year and try to get significantly better in that 1 area. And practice just enough in the other 3 areas so you don't lose ground there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're working on ball striking and you take a lesson from someone like me and I say to you, okay, we're going to work on your swing for the next year, and for the first 6 weeks, you're going to work on improving the mechanics of your takeaway by doing this drill every day in the mirror for 15 minutes, right? But you still got to practice your putting a little bit, your short game a little bit. You got to work on your mental focus skills a little bit, just so you don't go backwards in those three areas, right?
Right.
And then by the end of the year, that guy will be significantly better because he'll be hitting a lot more fairways and greens in regulation than he was at the start of the year because his mechanics are better.
Yeah, 2014 for me was a big year for dropping my scores down. And it was really, for me, I focused a lot at what I found to be the biggest hole in my game, which is my short game. Mm-hmm. And the concept of turning three shots into two when you're inside 100 yards. My problem is I still can't putt from 4 feet.
See, that's part of it. That's why you can't, like, you know, I'm always reluctant to make really ironclad statements about how to improve because so much of it depends on the person. So much of it's an individual case-by-case basis. So I always usually try to, like, sort of temper my remarks with, like, in general or for most people or with a certain within a certain handicap range, this statement's likely to be true. But it really comes down to if you study your game, and there are applications now you can put in your smartphone for basically when you finish the hole, you can quickly, you know, type in, you know, how many putts did you get up and down,
right?
Even track the length of your drive, whether you hit the fairway. You want to figure out what is the weak area. What's the number one weakest area that's costing you the most strokes? And then you want to fix that area. You want to fix that issue.
Yeah.
That's how you, right? But again, we talked about this, I think the last time I was on your show, we talked about sort of the new burgeoning field of golf statistics. And I think Mark Brody's book was brought, you brought up his book and
right.
Some other people.
Right. Mark was on the show.
Yeah. And to me, that's ironclad. And I've been teaching this for over 25 years now. I always tell people, look, you know, I know it defies conventional wisdom that putting is really important and that short game is really important, and it's just not true. What costs, especially mid to high handicap golfers, where they lose strokes, you know, again, there could be one out of 100 people where this doesn't apply, but 99 out of 100 people who are right around 15 handicaps or higher, if they could improve their long game by, say, 25%, they would score so much better. Because they are losing golf balls. They are hitting balls out of bounds. They are hitting balls in the deep rough, you know, behind trees, in the fairway bunkers. They're typically missing the green in their next shot. So now they have to rely on a really, really good short game to get up and down for par, right? So I don't mean an average. I mean like a tour pro quality. If you get in a really bad situation, your second shot on a par four where you've short-sighted yourself, right? Or you got a really bad lie in a bunker, or you're in the long grass, you'd have to have a tour pro quality short game to get up and down, right? Which, what are the odds of the average golfer is going to have even if he practiced a lot, he's going to get to a tour pro quality short game? It's not very practical. So you know, I think we talked about how last time, how my belief is that you need to learn a good enough golf swing where you can hit the driver long and straight. Because if you can hit a driver long and straight, you should be able to hit your irons and your hybrids into the green also, you know, the right distance and straight. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking about the golfers that are extremely good, and we'll go use your phrase of tour quality golfer. Uh-huh. Let's talk about tour players who are playing every day, all day, and yep. Have phenomenal mechanics. And hopefully have a decent enough mental game to get, or maybe they have none whatsoever because they've just always been a good golfer. How much help is a coach at that point?
Well, that's interesting you bring that, because that's the big thing that's being talked in the golf industry, because of Tiger, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's now got his fifth coach since he turned pro. I think it's his eighth coach in his lifetime. Chris Como is his new coach.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you this. There's only a handful of people on tour right now, on the regular tours, European Tour and PGA Tour, who do not have a swing coach. Very, very few do not.
But should they be tweaking these mechanics that have gotten them to this level?
Yeah, that's the big argument, isn't it? I would say if you look at the track record overall, it's more positive than negative. In other words, when a tour pro works with a coach, most of the time they see somewhere between a minor level improvement and a dramatic level of improvement. But there's always that sort of maybe 20% of the time where they can get worse. There's sort of like that level of risk, right? My philosophy is you have to do a really, really close statistical analysis of what their ball striking stats are to see would it ever justify making a radical. In general, if a tour pro came to me and wanted to work on their golf swing, I can't imagine I would make a radical change to their, like Tiger's gone through with mm-hmm. his teachings. I would be inclined, I'd be more as a coach, more along the lines of making like minor to moderately sized changes to their golf swing, but also work on their mental game, their mental focus, their routine, controlling their emotions, and their short game and their putting, kind of a mixture. But to do what Tiger does, yeah, it's pretty radical, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what would you do if Tiger called? What would you tell Tiger if he called you and said, I need some help?
I like a lot of the stuff that Sean Foley did with him in his golf swing. Obviously, Tiger, like me, I've been in the bad back camp in golf for two decades now, so I've been through the ringer on it. I've pretty much tried everything, so I know how that can affect your game. I would only make one major change. I actually believe Tiger Woods only has what I would call one major swing flaw right now. The swing we've seen since he came back from his back, 2 months ago, he's already made some changes that are better. He has less forward shaft lean than he had the last 2 years. There were some driver swings. You can find them on YouTube, where if you paused it at impact, his hands were like 8 inches ahead of the ball at impact with a driver, which is way too much shaft lean, right? Hmm. And not just the driver, all the clubs in the bag. He was getting too much shaft lean. And that creates all kinds of problems with solidness of contact and also accuracy, right? So he seems to kind of fix that for the most part. So assuming that fix is permanent, he still has one really big flaw that is something you would see like in a 25 handicap. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Well, he dips. And I don't mean dip a little bit. Most good players dip about 1 to 3 inches. So they increase their forward tilt of their torso spine angle toward the ground, increases a little bit. Most pros do, like an inch or so mm-hmm. on the transition. He dips down like 8 to 10 inches. So his chest gets too close to the ground.
On his downswing?
As soon as he starts his downswing.
Yeah.
He dips.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that means he's gonna hit it really, really fat unless he stands up, which, of course, he does most of the time. He has to stand up by almost the same amount to hit the ball solid. So talk about a compensation move. Yeah, he's got to totally stand up as he's striking the ball by several inches. And, you know, he's been doing this since he was a kid, so it's a really strong habit. But I think it's really holding him back. And if it were me, I'd say, Tiger, I know you don't want to fix this problem because it's something that's so natural to you, so deeply ingrained with, you know, probably a million golf swings in your life. But I think it could be fixed. I would fix that, and I wouldn't fix much else mechanically. He has a known tempo flaw, which is if you look at his driving range swing, it's noticeably slower and smoother tempo, particularly with the driver. And he's talked about this, where he hits the driver on the range like really long and really straight with a much slower, smoother tempo, and he walks to the first tee and he gets short and he gets fast.
Wow.
I mean, really fast. So he has, again, a flaw you would see in a mid to high handicap amateur, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, so, I can't tell you how many shows that we've done and just on taking your game from the range to the course, knowing that amateurs, it's one of the biggest complaints. I'm a scratch golfer on the driving range, right? But even for that level, I'm shocked.
Oh, yeah. Although I have to say, I would say he probably suffers from that more than any other well-known pro. And again, to his credit, he talks about it. He says, I'm Ranger Rick, meaning on the driving range, Ranger Rick. He goes, but the longest walk, that's the old saying, is from the range to the first tee. He says he's always struggled, apparently his whole life, with taking his range swing to the golf course. It's surprising, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I'm kind of stunned here.
Yeah, let me tell you else I would tell Tiger. So other than those two physical, one being tempo, the other would being the dipping too much, I would say I would have him do extreme exaggeration drills. I'd have him open the club face on his driver like, 20 degrees. Hmm. And aim way, way, way left. I'll say, Tiger, let's see if you can hit a 150-yard slice and have it end up at that tree in the right side of the range. Then have him do the opposite, 125-yard hook. Show me a driver that never gets higher than 15 feet off the ground. Then show me a driver that's sky high, right? And then I would have him do major changes to his normal golf swing. In other words, I'd have him do bizarre, exaggerated body mechanics and therefore club motion mechanics to produce unusual shots, like super high shots, super low shots, shots that curve a lot, right? Hit shots like put a styrofoam coffee cup upside down and put a golf ball on top of it. Try to hit a golf ball off of that. Or go out in the golf course to extreme side hill lie where the ball's way above his feet, right? Because what I know is that he used to practice like this with his dad, right? And that is a proven way of speeding up the mastery process in any sport of learning new movement patterns. I think a lot of the golfing public thinks you learn what the model golf swing is, and then you just try to match the model. And that certainly is a big part of it, for sure. But one of the ways we teach here at Balance Point is the opposite way, where we have people do these sensory awareness exercises with a club in their hand. Right? Mm-hmm. And it does two things. It expands your mind so you can start to feel more what your body and club are actually doing. Anytime you can increase your level of feel awareness for body and club motion, that's a good thing, right? And because you're hitting shots that by their very nature are very difficult to hit well, and you're actually hitting them well, which you will, for most people will, within a few minutes, it helps your confidence, right? Like one that I do a lot is we actually do it as part of the segment we do this, we do like a half a day on swing plane, swing geometry in our 3-day boot camp golf school. And at the end of that, this is a segment of that for people who have this typical high handicap over the top golf swing, where they hit a lot of poles to the left. Mm-hmm. We do about, 90 minutes of drills on that. And the last drill for people who have a severe over the top move, we call it the backwards drill. And it's sort of like it's an actual drill that I've known about for over 30 years, but it's also a little bit of comic relief. Because what I do is I actually hit the ball backwards. In other words, I stand so my back is facing the target. My club face is in the normal position, right? So my club face is directly aiming at the target, but my back is to the target. And everybody starts laughing because they think, oh, yeah, of course, nobody could hit it. And I usually hit it really good. Like I usually hit a hybrid about 200 yards or about a 10-yard draw on it. And it looks impossible. So people are thinking, holy, how can he possibly hit a, how can he hit a ball backwards? It doesn't even, you think it's impossible, but you know what? It's not that hard to do. So I have the students try it. And yeah, the first maybe 3 to 5, they hit really bad. And then by the 5th or 6th or 7th one, they're hitting it as good as their normal setup, right? From a starting position that should be impossible to do. And so that really helps your confidence. And what Tiger needs right now is a huge, huge jolt of confidence, don't you think?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Because when you look at his body language, he doesn't have the confidence. He doesn't walk around on the golf course with that like that prowling tiger, king of the jungle type of body language he used to have.
Well, he intimidated the competition.
Right.
When he was at his prime like that. But didn't Tiger at that point or at any point, or hasn't he exhibited the most creative use of shots and the widest range of different types of shots that you've ever seen?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He was known for that. And he kind of got away with it because he, not so much into Butch, because Butch knows about what I do. I'm sure Butch uses similar drills with his tour pros. But he got to Haney. Haney was a much more technical teacher than Butch Harmon was. And Sean Foley was like orders of magnitude more technical teacher than even Haney was. So the problem with I think too much of a technical approach is if you don't mix in equal parts of the creative part of golf, the artistic part, if it's all technique, look at video, put you on TrackMan, try to get better numbers, like Tiger was always saying on TrackMan. Try to hit better positions, replaying the video in slow motion. If you start getting too much down that road, it inhibits the artistic and the creative side of golf. And one reason I call my company Balance Point is I don't see those things as antithetical at all. I see them as complementary, but they can become antithetical if one becomes too dominant relative to the other. Hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So here's Tiger Woods went from being probably, if you wanted to put it in percentage, I would say he was a 90% field player as a junior, only 10% technical, right? Then when he was 17 years old, senior in high school, started working with Butch. And Butch is sort of closer to call, I would say Butch is probably more, maybe 70% feel, 30% technical, a rough approximation.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to Haney, who was probably 60% technical, 40% feel. Then he went to Sean Foley, who was like 90% technical, 10% more creative oriented. And I think Tiger just got off track. And I would have him go back toward maybe, for 6 months, or maybe a year, just get, don't look at any video. Don't go on track, man. Literally. Right. Just take a vacation from that stuff. Learn to play golf by feel again. I think that would be the most important advice I would give him, for sure.
Wow. Wow. Well, let's talk for a moment so people can get in touch with you about Balance Point Golf School. I know that I got an email the other day from one of the women that was on our Prague trip years ago, who's still a listener, and she said that she's on her way to Hawaii and she wanted to reach out to you in March. She was on the East Coast.
She sent yesterday. I'm gonna try calling her tomorrow and go over some options for her.
She's awesome.
Yeah, BJ, right?
Yeah, BJ.
I guess what can I tell you? I've been doing this. This is my 26th, the 21st year I've had the schools. I started in 1995 in the wintertime over here in Hawaii. Actually, that was over on the Big Island. I'm pretty proud of the company. I've got four assistant pros that work with me in the busy summer season in Portland. And in fact, one guy's been with me. This will be his 18th year. I got one 18-year-old veteran,
wow,
18 years with me, a 15-year-old, and a 13-year-old, and a 7-year-old. So they've all got a lot of experience.
That's great.
They're all good players, good golf swings. I consider myself a holistic instructor, and I teach all phases of the game, all parts of the game: mental game, short game, putting game, golf swing mechanics. Although I spend about 80% of my time teaching golf swing mechanics, that's what the marketplace demands. People want to have that type of instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it Balance Point because I use a mind-body connection model, which is basically it's a model based on neuroscience, which is how does the brain mind/body, how does that system work in terms of learning new movement patterns and in terms of performing to your highest potential when you play?
And the website is balancepointgolf.com?
Correct, balancepointgolf.com. And we have schools from May through October in Portland, spring and fall in Palm Springs, and wintertime on Oahu. I teach at Ko'olina Golf Club, which is about 20 minutes west of Waikiki,
okay,
on Oahu.
And you were telling me that you have an e-book now for us all to take advantage of.
I have our Great Shot, our most popular golf school is called Great Shot! And it's a 3-day boot camp, 8 hours a day, really intensive total immersion training on the range on those 30 laws of body motion, 6 laws of club motion. But again, mainly it's the 10 really important ones, 10 important laws of body motion. And that school has a 205-page training manual that I spent most of the summer rewriting and updating. And we've turned it into an ebook, and it'll be up on our website, I'm hoping, by the end of next week, which would be, around the 28th, 29th of January, something like that.
Okay, so by February 1st, it should be ready
to go. Yeah, it'll be downloadable.
And this is 2015 that we're talking about.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. We have a PDF version right now, but you have to call the office to get that one. But this will be EPUB. EPUB will play on any device, from a tablet to a smartphone to a desktop computer.
Right.
And I'm also, while I'm here in Hawaii, I'm working on updating the short game, putting game and mental game training manuals. So those will be available as ebooks. I'm hoping by middle to end of the summer. And I'm involved in reshooting our Great Shot Golf Swing training program, which I did, God, it's been 20 years ago, which was back in the VHS tape days, the VCR.
Yeah, time to reshoot that one.
Yeah, with a brand new Panasonic 2014 high-def camera with a really good audio system.
I'll tell you, the video that you shot it with then, you could shoot with your phone now and it would look better.
Well, I know it would. There's no question.
Amazing.
So we're about a third through the shooting. We've got module one and module two almost done. We're going to sell them as individual modules. It's going to be five modules total. It'll be almost exactly 24 hours of viewing time. It's everything I know about the golf swing. And it's designed to be a self-directed sort of training program. So you can download the whole thing, and you can take 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever long you want to learn the golf swing in its sequential order, where certain things are more important than other things, like I mentioned at the start of the conversation. And a beginner golfer could take this program and by the end of the first year have a really good golf swing. And a professional golfer could go to the parts that apply more to them. So it's going to go from the real simple, basic sort of introductory fundamentals all the way through when you get closer to the 20-hour mark to the really advanced stuff. So I'm pretty proud of it. It's everything I know about the golf swing.
Awesome. And you do know a lot. I mean, it's amazing to me how fast an hour can go by when we get on the phone together.
It is. Has it been an hour? Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. We've been recording for over an hour.
Wow. Incredible.
All right. Well, Jim, as always, I just love having you on this podcast. I love to listen to you. I learn so much. I really appreciate that you share so much time with us.
Oh, not a problem. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, as you know. We got to do the Thai meal again this summer.
Okay. We got to go out for some more food. And that was episode number 400. And we're approaching this summer. We're going to be coming up to number 500. So maybe this summer we'll get together.
I'm honored. I got to four. And I think this is my 10th time, I think, right? 9th or 10th.
I haven't looked, but yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it was at least 10 times.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Jim, I need to make a couple of announcements first, but I want to come back to close this episode with your takeaway or your tip from this conversation. Okay. So, yeah, there's some changes coming to Golf Smarter, and the first is that we're going to end each episode with a helpful tip from our guest. You're also going to receive a video email from me with this tip. As you heard me mention last time out, the members-only platform, for lack of a better word, is being phased out for our all-new Golf Smarter Premium Access. In the past, members received complete interviews, sometimes over two episodes. But with our new Premium Access, you'll get the entire interview, intact and unedited, each week. Those who choose to just get the free episode will only hear about 10 to 15 minutes of the show. But like with today's conversation with Jim, you will get the entire hour. The other great aspect of Premium Access is that it will be delivered directly to your mobile device from our all-new and free Golf Smarter app. It's currently available for Android on both Google Play and at Amazon. As of this recording, we've yet to receive confirmation from Apple, but that's coming at any minute. So please check the App Store for the Golf Smarter app regularly. Now, the Golf Smarter app will allow you to stream our podcasts directly to your phone or tablet without having to sync to your computer. That is huge. Also, our new app will have bonus features, including wallpapers for your phone, videos, and access to our entire archives. One of the best things for you is that these apps, the payments for premium, and all the technical issues will be handled by Libsyn, company Liberated Syndication, Libsyn. You may have seen them in iTunes listed as Wizard Media. Libsyn publishes some of the top podcasts available, so they know what they're doing. I really hope that you will stay with us for these changes and continue your support of Golf Smarter. You know how grateful I am. Golf Smarter for members only will expire at the end of May 2015. So if you're currently a member, you can continue to listen that way. But once your membership expires, and you still want even more benefits than you've ever received in the past, please sign up for our premium access for 1, 6, or 12 months. By June 1st, our members-only shows will cease to be published. So for more information or to email me, go to our new podcast page at golfsmarter.libsyn.com. Libsyn is L-I-B-S-Y-N. That's golfsmarter.libsyn.com. Or click on the podcast link at golfsmarter.com. Now, Jim, let's wrap this up with your closing tip.
Well, I think the main tip is you need to understand that in golf, you never aim your body at the target. That is, aiming the body at the target is one of the most common golf swing misconceptions that new students bring to the table when I work with them in schools and lessons. I mean, to the point where people will actually take a club and put it across their shoulders and kind of look at their target and go like that, and aim their shoulder. You know what I'm talking about? You see people do that? Usually, almost always high handicaps do that. Your body has no relationship to the target in golf. The only relationship to the target is with the golf ball, hopefully going to the target when you're done hitting it, and your club face. So the key is to aim your club face exactly at your intended target and never try to aim your body to the target. Your body does not aim to the target. Your body positions itself parallel left of a 3 foot long chunk of target line with the ball sitting in the middle of that 3 foot long chunk. So once you're done aiming your club face precisely at the target, you simply look down at the ball and you see an imaginary line 18 inches either side of the ball, right? That's your 3 foot long chunk of target line. And you position your toe line, your feet, your knees, your hips, your shoulder girdle, even your eye line parallel to that 3 foot long chunk of line. Like you're standing on the inner rail of a railroad track and the ball is in that 3 foot long chunk of target line is the outer rail, right? You want to keep those two rails parallel to each other. Never aim your body out to the target, only the club face.